But now, writhing under the domination of Grenville and his friends, alarmed at the growing disorder and disaffection of the country, aware at last of his folly in alienating the Whig families, the king sought a reconciliation. In July 1765, the Marquess of Rockingham, a shy, well-meaning Whig who was disturbed at George's conduct, undertook to form a government, and brought with him as private secretary a young Irishman named Edmund Burke, already known in literary circles as a clever writer and a brilliant talker. He was much more. He was a great political thinker. Viewing English politics and the English character with something of the detachment of an alien, he was able to diagnose the situation with an imaginative insight beyond the range of those immersed in the business of the day and bound by traditional habits of mind. The political history of the years following 1714 had led to a degeneration and dissolution of parties. The personal activity of the sovereign after 1760 and the emergence of great issues of principle found the Whigs helpless and divided into rival clans. The king's tactics had paralysed them. Burke's aim was to create out of the Rockingham group, high-principled but small in numbers and with no original ideas of its own, an effective political party. He could supply the ideas, but first he had to convince the Whigs that a party could be formed and held together on a ground of common principles. He had to overcome the notion, widely prevalent, that party was in itself a rather disreputable thing, a notion which had been strengthened by Pitt's haughty disdain for party business and organisation. It was an old tradition that politicians not in power need not bother to attend Parliament, but should retire to their country estates and there await the return to royal favour and a redistribution of the sweets of office. Individualists of different schools, such as Shelburne and Henry Fox, consistently opposed Burke's efforts to organise them into a party. "You think," Henry Fox had written to Rockingham, "you can but serve the country by continuing a fruitless opposition. I think it impossible to serve it at all except by coming into office." A consistent programme, to be advocated in opposition and realised in office, was Burke's conception of party policy, and the new issues arising plainly required a programme. On Ireland, on America, on India, Burke's attitude was definite. He stood, and he brought his party to stand, for conciliation of the colonies, relaxation of the restraints on Irish trade, and the government of India on the same moral basis as the government of England. At home he proposed to deliver Parliament from its subservience to the Crown by the abolition of numerous sinecures and the limitation of corruption. What he lacked was, in his own words, the power and purchase which a strong and well-organised party could supply. For years Burke was a voice crying in the wilderness, and too often rising to tones of frenzy. An orator to be named with the ancients, an incomparable political reasoner, he lacked both judgment and self-control. He was, perhaps, the greatest man that Ireland has produced. The same gifts, with a dash of English indolence and irony — he could have borrowed them from Charles James Fox, Henry Fox's famous son, who had plenty of both to spare — might have made him Britain's greatest statesman. Rockingham's government, which lasted 13 months, passed 3 measures that went far to soothe the animosities raised by Grenville on both sides of the Atlantic. They repealed the Stamp Act, and induced the House of Commons to declare general warrants and the seizure of private papers unlawful. At the same time they reaffirmed the powers of Parliament to tax the colonies in a so-called Declaratory Act. But the king was determined to be rid of them, and Pitt, whose mind was clouded by sickness, was seduced by royal flattery and by his own dislike of party into lending his name to a new administration formed on no political principle whatever. His arrogance remained. His powers were failing. His popularity as the great commoner had been dimmed by his sudden acceptance of the earldom of Chatham. The conduct of affairs slipped into other hands. Charles Townshend, the Duke of Grafton, and Lord Shelburne. In 1767, Townshend, against the opposition of Shelburne, introduced a bill imposing duties on American imports of paper, glass, lead, and tea. There was rage in America. The supply of coin in the colonies would be still more depleted, and any surplus from the new revenue was not, as originally stated, to be used for the upkeep of the British garrisons, but to pay British colonial officials. This threatened to make them independent of the colonial assemblies, whose chief weapon against truculent governors had been to withhold their salaries. Even so, revolt was still far from their minds. Intelligent men like Governor Hutchinson of Massachusetts preferred not to impose taxes at all if they could not be enforced, and declared that another appeal would only facilitate the designs of those persons who appear to be aiming at independency. John Dickinson of Pennsylvania, in his Letters from a Farmer, voiced the opposition in the most widely read pamphlet of the time. It was studiously cautious in tone, and at this stage there were few people who desired secession. The authority of Parliament over the colonies was formally denied, but there was a general loyalty to King and Empire. Most of the opposition still came from respectable merchants, who believed that organized but limited resistance on the commercial plane would bring the British government to reason. The Massachusetts Assembly accordingly proposed a joint petition with the other colonial bodies against the new duties. Colonial resistance was now being organized on a continental scale, and the barriers of provincialism and jealousy were being lowered. Non-importation agreements were concluded, and there was a systematic and most successful boycott of English goods. But tempers began to rise. In May 1768, the sloop Liberty, belonging to John Hancock, the most prominent Boston merchant, was stopped and searched near the coast by Royal Customs officers. The colonists rescued it by force. By 1769, British exports to America had fallen by one half. The cabinet was not seriously apprehensive, but perturbed. It agreed to drop the duties, except on tea. By a majority of one, this was carried. Parliament proclaimed its sovereignty over the colonies by retaining a tax on tea of threepence a pound. Suddenly, by some mysterious operation of nature, the clouds which had gathered round Chatham's intellect cleared. Ill health had forced him to resign in 1768, and he'd been succeeded in office by Grafton. The scene on which he reopened his eyes was lurid enough to dismay any man. In England, as we have seen, a senseless craving for revenge had driven the King and his friends in Parliament to an attempt to expel John Wilkes from the House, which was, in fact, an attack on the rights of electors throughout the country. The unknown Junius was flaying every minister who provoked his lash. In America, blood had not yet flowed, but all the signs of a dissolution of the empire were there for those who could read them. But George III, after 12 years' intrigue, had at last got a docile, biddable prime minister. Lord North became First Lord of the Treasury in 1770. A charming man of good abilities and faultless temper, he presided over the loss of the American colonies. At first, all seemed quiet. The American merchants were delighted at the repeal of the import duties, and by the middle of 1770, reconciliation seemed complete, except in Boston. Here, Samuel Adams, fertile organizer of resistance and advocate of separation, saw that the struggle was now reaching a crucial stage. Hitherto, the quarrel had been at bottom a commercial dispute, and neither the American merchants nor the English ministers had any sympathy for his ideas. Adams feared that the resistance of the colonies would crumble, and the British would reassert their authority unless more trouble was stirred up. This he and other radical leaders proceeded to do. News that the duties were withdrawn had hardly reached America when the first blood was shed. Most of the British garrison was stationed in Boston. The troops were unpopular with the townsfolk, and Adams spread evil rumours of their conduct. The lobsters, in their scarlet coats, were insulted and jeered at wherever they appeared. In March 1770, the persistent snowballing by Boston urchins of English sentries outside the barracks caused a riot. In the confusion and shouting, some of the troops opened fire, and there were casualties. This massacre was just the sort of incident that Adams had hoped for. but moderate men of property were nervous, and opinion in the colonies remained disunited and uncertain. The radicals persisted. In June 1772, rioters burned a British revenue cutter, HMS Gaspé, off Rhode Island. Committees of correspondence were set up throughout Massachusetts, and by the end of the year had spread to 75 towns. The Virginian agitators, led by the young Patrick Henry, created a standing committee of their assembly to keep in touch with the other colonies, and a chain of such bodies was quickly formed. Thus the machinery of revolt was quietly and efficiently created. Nevertheless, the radicals were still in a minority, and there was much opposition to an abrupt break with England. Benjamin Franklin, one of the leading colonial representatives in London, wrote as late as 1773, "There seem to be among us some violent spirits who are for an immediate rupture, but I trust that the general prudence of our country will see that by our growing strength we advance fast to a situation in which our claims must be allowed, that by a premature struggle we may be crippled and kept down, that between governed and governing, every mistake in government, every encroachment on right, is not worth a rebellion. Remembering withal that this Protestant country, our mother, though lately an unkind one, is worth preserving, and that her weight in the scales of Europe, and her safety in a great degree, may depend upon our union with her." In spite of the Boston massacre, the violence on the high seas, and the commercial squabbles, the agitations of Adams and his friends were beginning to peter out, when Lord North committed a fatal blunder. The East India Company was nearly bankrupt, and the government had been forced to come to its rescue. An act was passed through Parliament, attracting little notice among the members, authorizing the company to ship tea, of which it had an enormous surplus, direct to the colonies without paying import duties, and to sell it through its own agents in America. Thus, in effect, the company was granted a monopoly. The outcry across the Atlantic was instantaneous. The extremists denounced it as an invasion of their liberties, and the merchants were threatened with ruin. American shippers who brought tea from the British customs houses and their middlemen who sold it would all be thrown out of business. The act succeeded where Adams had failed. It united colonial opinion against the British. The radicals, who began to call themselves patriots, seized their opportunity to force a crisis. In December 1773, the first cargoes arrived in Boston. Rioters, disguised as Red Indians, boarded the ships and destroyed the cases. "Last night," wrote John Adams, Samuel's cousin and later the second President of the United States, "three cargoes of Bohea tea were emptied into the sea. This is the most magnificent movement of all. There is a dignity, a majesty and sublimity in this last effort of the patriots that I greatly admire. This destruction of the tea is so bold, so daring, so firm, intrepid, and inflexible, and it must have so important consequences and so lasting, that I cannot but consider it as an epoch in history. This, however, is but an attack upon property. Another similar exertion of popular power may produce the destruction of lives. Many persons wish that as many dead carcasses were floating in the harbour as there are chests of tea. A much less number of lives, however, would remove the causes of all our calamities." When the news reached London, the cry went up for coercion, and the reactionaries in the British government became supreme. In vain, Burke and Chatham pleaded for conciliation. Parliament passed a series of coercion acts, which suspended the Massachusetts Assembly, declared the colony to be in crown hands, closed the port of Boston, and decreed that all judges in the colony were henceforth to be appointed by the crown. These measures were confined to Massachusetts. Only one of them, the Quartering Act, applied to the rest of the colonies, and this declared that troops were to be quartered throughout all of them to preserve order. Thus it was hoped to isolate the resistance. It had the opposite effect. In September 1774, the Colonial Assemblies held a congress at Philadelphia. The extremists were not yet out of hand, and the delegates still concentrated on commercial boycotts. An association was formed to stop all trade with England unless the Coercion Acts were repealed, and the committees of correspondence were charged with carrying out the plan. A Declaration of Rights demanded the rescinding of some 13 commercial acts passed by the British Parliament since 1763. The tone of this document, which was dispatched to London, was one of respectful moderation. But in London, all moderation was cast aside. The sugar interest in the House of Commons, jealous of colonial competition in the West Indies, army officers who despised the colonial troops, the government, pressed for money and blinded by the doctrine that colonies only existed for the benefit of the mother country, all combined to extinguish the last hope of peace. The petition was rejected with contempt. Events now move swiftly. The Massachusetts military governor, General Thomas Gage, tried to enforce martial law, but the task was beyond him. Gage was an able soldier, but he had only 4,000 troops and could hold no place outside Boston. The Patriots had about 10,000 men in the colonial militia. In October, they set up a committee of safety, and most of the colonies started drilling and arming. Collection of military equipment and powder began. Cannon were seized from government establishments. Agents were sent to Europe to buy weapons. Both France and Spain refused the British government's request to prohibit the sale of gunpowder to the Americans, and Dutch merchants shipped it in large glass bottles labelled spirits. The Patriots began accumulating these warlike stores at Concord, a village 20 miles from Boston, where the Massachusetts Assembly, which Parliament had declared illegal, was now in session. Gage decided to seize their ammunition and arrest Samuel Adams and his colleague John Hancock. But the colonists were on the alert. Every night they patrolled the streets of Boston, watching for any move by the English troops. As Gage gathered his men, messengers warned the assembly at Concord. The military supplies were scattered among towns farther north, and Adams and Hancock moved to Lexington. On April the 18th, 1775, 800 British troops set off in darkness along the Concord Road. But the secret was out. One of the patrols, Paul Revere, from his post in the steeple of the North Church, warned messengers by lantern signals. He himself mounted his horse and rode hard to Lexington, rousing Adams and Hancock from their beds and urging them to flight. At 5 o'clock in the morning, the local militia of Lexington, 70 strong, formed up on the village green. As the sun rose, the head of the British column, with 3 officers riding in front, came into view. The leading officer, brandishing his sword, shouted, "Disperse, you rebels, immediately!" The militia commander ordered his men to disperse. The colonial committees were very anxious not to fire the first shot, and there were strict orders not to provoke open conflict with the British regulars. But in the confusion, someone fired. A volley was returned. The ranks of the militia were thinned, and there was a general melee. Brushing aside the survivors, the British column marched on to Concord. But now the countryside was up in arms, and the bulk of the stores had been moved to safety. It was with difficulty that the British straggled back to Boston, with the enemy close at their heels. The town was cut off from the mainland. The news of Lexington and Concord spread to the other colonies, and governors and British officials were expelled. With strategic insight, forts on Lake George, at the head of the Hudson Valley, were seized by a Patriot force under Benedict Arnold, a merchant from Connecticut. The British were thus denied any help from Canada. And the War of Independence had begun. Chapter 7. The War of Independence. In May 1775, a congress of delegates from the American colonies met in the Carpenter's Hall of the quiet Pennsylvanian town of Philadelphia. They were respectable lawyers, doctors, merchants, and landowners, nervous at the onrush of events, and seemingly unfitted to form a revolutionary committee. The first shots had been fired, and blood had been shed, but all hope of compromise had not yet vanished, and they were fearful of raising a military power which might, like Cromwell's Ironsides, overwhelm its creators. They had no common national tradition except that against which they were revolting. No organization, no industries, no treasury, no supplies, no army. Many of them still hoped for peace with England. Yet British troops under General Sir William Howe were on their way across the Atlantic, and armed, violent, fratricidal conflict stared them in the face. The centre of resistance and the scene of action was Boston, where Gage and the only British force on the continent were hemmed in by 16,000 New England merchants and farmers. There was continual friction within the town, not only between patriots and soldiery, but between patriots and loyalists. Derisive placards were hung outside the quarters of the troops, and all was in ferment. On May the 25th, Howe, accompanied by Generals Clinton and Burgoyne, sailed into the harbour with reinforcements, which brought the total English troops to about 6,000 men. Thus strengthened, Gage took the offensive. To the north, across a short tract of water, lay a small peninsula connected by a narrow neck with the mainland. Here, Breed's Hill and Bunker Hill dominated the town. If the colonists could occupy and hold these eminences, they could cannonade the English out of Boston. On the evening of June the 16th, Gage determined to forestall them. But next morning, a line of entrenchments had appeared upon the heights across the water. Patriot troops, warned by messages from Boston, had dug themselves in during the night. Their position, nevertheless, seemed perilous. The English ships could bombard them from the harbour or put landing parties on the neck of the peninsula and cut them off from their base. But neither course was attempted. Gage was resolved on a display of force. He had under his command some of the best regiments in the British army, and he and his fellow countrymen had acquired a hard contempt for the colonials in earlier wars. He decided to make a frontal attack on the hill, so that all Boston, crowded in its windows and upon its roofs, should witness the spectacle of British soldiers marching steadily in line to storm the rebel entrenchments. On the hot afternoon of the 17th, Howe, under Gage's orders, supervised the landing of about 3,000 British regulars. He drew up his men and made them a speech. "You must drive these farmers from the hill, or it will be impossible for us to remain in Boston. But I shall not desire any of you to advance a single step beyond where I am, at the head of your line." In three lines, the redcoats moved slowly towards the summit of Breed's Hill. There was silence. The whole of Boston was looking on. At 100 yards from the trenches, there was still not a sound in front. But at 50 yards, a hail of buckshot and bullets from ancient hunting guns smote the attackers. There were shouting and curses. "Are the Yankees cowards?" was hurled from the breastworks of the trenches. Howe, his white silk breeches splashed with blood, rallied his men, but they were scattered by another volley and driven to their boats. Howe's reputation was at stake, and he realized that ammunition was running short on the hilltop. At the third rush, this time in column, the regulars drove the farmers from their line. It was now evening. The village of Charlestown, on the Boston side of the peninsula, was in flames. Over 1,000 Englishmen had fallen on the slopes. Of the 3,000 farmers who held the crest, a sixth were killed or wounded. Throughout the night, carriages and chaises bore the English casualties into Boston. This sharp and bloody action sent a stir throughout the colonies, and has been compared in its effects with Bull Run 86 years later. The rebels had become heroes. They'd stood up to trained troops, destroyed a third of their opponents, and wiped out in blood the legend of Yankee cowardice. The British had captured the hill, but the Americans had won the glory. Gage made no further attack, and in October he was recalled to England in disgrace. Howe succeeded to the command. On both sides of the Atlantic, men perceived that a mortal struggle impended. It was now imperative for the patriots to raise an army. Massachusetts had already appealed to Congress at Philadelphia for help against the British, and for the appointment of a commander-in-chief. 2 days before the action at Breed's Hill, Congress had agreed. There'd been much talk of whom they were to choose. There was jealousy and dislike of the New Englanders, who were bearing the brunt of the fighting, and largely for political reasons, it was decided to appoint a southerner. Adams's eyes centered upon a figure in uniform among the dark brown clothes of the delegates. He was Colonel George Washington of Mount Vernon, Virginia. This prosperous planter had fought in the campaigns of the 1750s and had helped extricate the remnants of Braddock's force from their disastrous advance. He was the only man of any military experience at the Congress, and this was limited to a few minor campaigns on the frontier. He was now given command of all the forces that America could raise. Great calls were to be made on the spirit of resolution that was his by nature. The colonies contained about 280,000 men capable of bearing arms, but at no time during the war did Washington succeed in gathering together more than 25,000. His immediate task was to provide the ragged band at Boston with discipline and munitions, and to this he devoted the autumn-winter months of 1775. Congress nevertheless resolved on an offensive. An expedition was dispatched to Canada under Benedict Arnold, who was to be forever infamous in American history, and Richard Montgomery, who had once served under Wolfe. They marched along the same routes which the British troops had taken in the campaign of 1759, and they had only 1,100 men between them. Montgomery captured and occupied Montreal, which was undefended. He then joined Arnold, who, after desperate hardships, had arrived with the ghost of an army before the fortifications of Quebec. In the depth of winter, in driving snow, they flung themselves at the Heights of Abraham, defended by Sir Guy Carleton with a few hundred men. Montgomery was killed, and Arnold's leg was shattered. The survivors, even after this repulse, hung on in their windswept camp across the river. But in the spring, when the ice melted in the St. Lawrence, the first reinforcements arrived from England. Having lost more than half their men, the Patriots thereupon trudged back to Maine and fought Ticonderoga. Canada thus escaped the revolutionary upsurge. French Canadians were, on the whole, content with life under the British crown. Soon Canada was to harbour many refugees from the United States who were unable to forswear their loyalty to George III. Meanwhile, Howe was still confined to Boston. He shrank from taking reprisals, and for at least the first 2 years of the war he hoped for conciliation. Both he and his generals were Whig members of Parliament, and they shared the party view that a successful war against the colonists was impossible. He was a gallant and capable commander in the field, but always slow to take the initiative. He now set himself the task of overawing the Americans. This, however, needed extensive help from England, and as none arrived, and Boston itself was of no strategic importance, he evacuated the town in the spring of 1776 and moved to the only British base on the Atlantic seaboard, Halifax, in Nova Scotia. At the same time, a small expedition under General Clinton was sent southwards to the Loyalists in Charleston in the hope of rallying the middle and southern colonies. But the Patriot resistance was stiffening, and although the moderate elements in Congress had hitherto opposed any formal declaration of independence, the evacuation of Boston roused them to a sterner effort. Until they acquired what would nowadays be called belligerent status, they could get no military supplies from abroad, except by smuggling, and supplies were essential. The conservative politicians were gradually yielding to the radicals. The publication of a pamphlet called Common Sense by Tom Paine, an English extremist lately arrived in America, put the case for revolution with enormous success and with far greater effect than the writings of intellectuals like Adams. But it was the British government which took the next step towards dissolving the tie of allegiance between England and America. Early in 1776, Parliament passed a prohibitory act, forbidding all intercourse with the rebellious colonies and declaring a blockade of the American coast. At the same time, it being impossible to raise enough British troops, Hessians were hired from Germany and dispatched across the Atlantic. The resulting outcry in America strengthened the hands of the extremists. At Philadelphia, on June 7th, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moved the following resolution: "That these United Colonies are, and of right ought to be, free and independent states. That they are absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is and ought to be totally dissolved." But 6 of the 13 colonies still opposed an immediate declaration. A large-scale British invasion was feared. No foreign alliances had yet been concluded. Many felt that a formal defiance would wreck their cause and alienate their supporters. But at last a committee was appointed, a paper was drafted by Thomas Jefferson, and on July the 4th, 1776, the Declaration of Independence was unanimously accepted by the Congress of the American Colonies. This historic document proclaimed the causes of the revolt and enumerated 28 repeated injuries and usurpations by the King of Great Britain. The opening is familiar and immortal. "When, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect to the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." The Declaration was in the main a restatement of the principles which had animated the Whig struggle against the later Stuarts and the English Revolution of 1688, and it now became the symbol and rallying centre of the Patriot cause. Its immediate result was to increase the number of loyalists frightened by this splendid defiance. But the purpose of the colonies was proclaimed. The waverers were forced to a decision. There was now no turning back. All this time, the British had remained at Halifax, awaiting reinforcements from England and meditating their strategy. Military success hinged on control of the Hudson Valley. If they could seize and hold the waterway and the forts which guarded it, New England would be sundered from the middle and southern colonies, which contained 2/3 of the population and most of the food and wealth. The first step was to capture New York at the river mouth. Howe could then move northwards, subdue the forts, and join hands with a force from Canada. Thereafter the south, where the settlements lay largely upon the rivers, could be crushed with the help of the fleet. The plan seemed promising, for the colonists possessed no navy, and Great Britain should have been able to blockade the Atlantic seaboard. But the fleet was no longer in the high efficiency to which it had been raised by Chatham's admirals. It was able to bring reinforcements across the Atlantic, but in the event, New England privateers did much damage to military operations on the coast and harassed transport vessels and supplies. In June 1776, Howe moved to New York and began to invest the city, and in July his brother, Admiral Howe, arrived from England with a fleet of over 500 sail and reinforcements. Howe was now in command of some 25,000 men. This was the largest armed force that had yet been seen in the New World. But Washington was ready. He concentrated his army, now reduced by desertions and smallpox to about 20,000 men, around the city. From the British camp on Staten Island, the American lines could be seen across the bay on the spurs of Long Island and on the heights of Brooklyn above the East River. In August, Howe attacked. The slaughter of Bunker Hill, for thus the action at Breed's Hill is known, had taught him caution, and this time he abstained from a frontal assault. He made a feint against the Long Island entrenchments, and then flung his main force to the left of the Americans and descended upon their rear. The stroke succeeded, and Washington was compelled to retreat into New York City. Adverse winds impeded the British fleet, and he and his army escaped safely across the East River. In this disaster, Washington appealed to Congress. It seemed impossible to make a stand in New York, yet to abandon it would dismay the Patriots. But Congress ordered him to evacuate the city without fighting, and after skirmishing on the Harlem Heights, he withdrew slowly northwards. At this juncture, victory lay at Howe's fingertips. He was master of New York, and of the Hudson River for 40 miles above it. If he pursued Washington with the same skill and vigor as Grant was to pursue Lee 88 years later, he might have captured the whole colonial army. But for nearly a month, Washington was unmolested. At the end of October, he was again defeated in a sharp fight at White Plains. But once more the English made no attempt to pursue, and Washington waited desperately to see whether Howe would attack up the Hudson or strike through New Jersey at Philadelphia. Howe resolved to move on Philadelphia. He turned south, capturing as he went the forts in the neighborhood of New York, and the delegates at Philadelphia fled. Thousands of Americans flocked to the British camp to declare their loyalty. The only hope for the Patriots seemed a mass trek across the Alleghenies into new lands, a migration away from British rule like that of the Boers in the 19th century. Even Washington considered such a course. "We must then, if defeated, retire to Augusta County in Virginia. Numbers will repair to us for safety, and we will try a predatory war. If overpowered, we must cross the Allegheny Mountains." Meanwhile, he traversed the Hudson and fell back southwards to cover Philadelphia. The British were hard on his heels and began a rapid occupation of New Jersey. The Patriot cause seemed lost, but Washington remained alert and undaunted, and fortune rewarded him. With an imprudence which is difficult to understand and was soon to be punished, outposts from the British army were flung about in careless fashion through the New Jersey towns. Washington determined to strike at these isolated bodies before Howe could cross the Delaware River. He selected the village of Trenton, held by a force of Hessians. On Christmas night, the Patriot troops fought their way into the lightly guarded village. At a cost of 2 officers and 2 privates, they killed or wounded 106 Hessians. The survivors were captured and sent to parade the streets of Philadelphia. The effect of the stroke was out of all proportion to its military importance. It was the most critical moment in the war. At Princeton, Lord Cornwallis, a subordinate of Howe's, of whom more was to be heard later, tried to avenge the defeat, but was foiled. Washington marched behind him and threatened his line of communications. The year thus ended with the British in winter quarters in New Jersey, but confined by these 2 actions to the east of the Delaware. Their officers spent a cheerful season in the society of New York. Meanwhile, Benjamin Franklin and Silas Deane, first of American diplomats, crossed the Atlantic to seek help from France. Posterity should not be misled into thinking that war on the American colonies received the unanimous support of the British people. Burke, for one, had no illusions. "No man," he had written after Bunker Hill, "commends the measures which have been pursued, or expects any good from those which are in preparation. But it is a cold, languid opinion, like what men discover in affairs that do not concern them. The merchants are gone from us and from themselves. The leading men among them are kept full-fed with contracts and remittances and jobs of all descriptions, and are indefatigable in their endeavours to keep the others quiet. They all, or the greatest number of them, begin to snuff the cadaverous goo of lucrative war. War is indeed become a sort of substitute for commerce. The freighting business never was so lively on account of the prodigious taking up for transport service. Great orders for provisions and stores of all kinds keep up the spirits of the mercantile world, and induce them to consider the American war not so much their calamity as their resource in an inevitable distress. Powerful English politicians denounced not only the military and naval mismanagement, but the use of force against the colonists at all. There was gloating over every setback and disaster to the British cause. "The parasite joy of some in the losses of their country makes me mad," wrote a government supporter. "They do not disguise it. A patriotic duke told me some weeks ago that some ships had been lost off the coast of North America in a storm. He said 1,000 British sailors were drowned, not one escaped, with joy sparkling in his eyes. In the House of Commons, it is not unusual to speak of the provincials as our army." Such antics only made things worse. Indeed, but for the violence of the opposition, which far outran the country's true feelings, it's probable that Lord North's administration would have fallen much sooner. As it was, he commanded large majorities in the House of Commons throughout the war. Not all the opposition members were so foolish or so extreme, but in the King's mind, all were traitors. George III grew stubborn and even more intent. He closed his ears to moderate counsel and refused to admit into his government those men of both parties who, like many American loyalists, foresaw and condemned the disasters into which his policy was tottering, and were horrified at the civil war between the mother country and her colonies. Even Lord North was half-hearted, and only his loyalty to the King and his sincere old-fashioned belief, shared by many politicians of his day, that a minister's duty was to carry out the personal wishes of the sovereign, stopped him resigning much sooner than he did. Though technically responsible as First Lord of the Treasury and Chancellor of the Exchequer, he had no grip on the conduct of affairs, and allowed the King and the departmental ministers to control the day-to-day work of government. George III tirelessly struggled to superintend the details of the war organization, but he was incapable of coordinating the activities of his ministers. These were of poor quality. The Admiralty was headed by Wilkes's comrade in debauch, the Earl of Sandwich. His reputation has been mauled, but recent research has shown that at least the fleet was in much better condition than the army. Rarely has British strategy fallen into such a multitude of errors. Every maxim and principle of war was either violated or disregarded. Seek out and destroy the enemy is a sound rule. Concentrate your force is a sound method. Maintain your objective is common sense. The enemy was Washington's army. The force consisted of Howe's troops in New York and Burgoyne's columns now assembled in Montreal. The objective was to destroy Washington's army and kill or capture Washington. If he could be brought to battle and every man and gun turned against him, a British victory was almost certain. But these obvious truths were befogged and bedeviled by multiplicity of counsel. Howe was still determined to capture Philadelphia, the seat of the Revolutionary Congress and the fountainhead of political resistance. Burgoyne, on the other hand, was hot for a descent from Canada into the upper reaches of the Hudson Valley, and a seizure, with the aid of a thrust from New York, of the forts which dominated the waterway. Once in control of the Hudson, New England could be isolated and speedily subdued. Burgoyne had obtained leave of absence and journeyed to England late in the autumn of 1775. He offered his advice to the London government. George III approved his plan and endorsed it in his own hand. Burgoyne was to advance from Montreal through the wooded borders of the frontier and seize the fort of Ticonderoga near the valley head. At the same time, a force from New York would strike north, capture the citadel of West Point, which had recently been strengthened with the help of French engineers, and join him at Albany. Thus the London planners. The ultimate responsibility for coordinating these movements lay with the War Minister, Lord George Germain. Germain's career in the army had ended in disgrace, though his military experience may not have been a fair guide to his capacities. 20 years before, he'd refused to charge with his cavalry at the Battle of Minden, and had been declared unfit to serve by a court-martial. But, secure in the favour of the young king, he'd made himself into a politician. The government were well aware that Howe intended to move in the opposite direction to Burgoyne, namely, southwards against Philadelphia, but did nothing to dissuade him. They gave him no orders to join forces at Albany, and they stinted him of reinforcements. "The extraordinary spectacle was thus presented," writes an American historian, "of a subordinate general going to London and getting the king's approval to one plan of campaign, of the king's minister sending full instructions to one general and none to the other who was to cooperate with him, and of this other general making his own independent plan." On his return to Canada, Burgoyne nevertheless sent Howe no fewer than 3 letters about the plan to meet at Albany. But in the absence of precise directions from England, Howe saw no reason to abandon his project against Philadelphia. He held to his course. Having tried and failed to bring Washington to battle, he left a garrison of 8,000 men in New York under Sir Henry Clinton, and sailed in July 1777 with the main part of his army to Chesapeake Bay. Instead of concentrating their strength, the British forces were now dispersed over 800 miles of country, and divided between Burgoyne in Canada, Howe on the Chesapeake, and Clinton in New York. Washington, from his winter quarters at Morristown on the borders of New Jersey, moved hastily southwestwards to screen Philadelphia. Having abandoned New York without a serious fight, he could hardly do the same at the capital of the Congress. But with his ill-disciplined force, fluctuating in numbers, he could only hope to delay the British advance. At the beginning of September, Howe advanced with about 14,000 men. Washington, with a similar force, drew up his lines on the north bank of the River Brandywine, barring the road to the capital. Howe perceived and exploited the faulty equipment of the army in front of him, its lack of an efficient staff, and its inability to get quick information. He made the same feinting movements which had served so well at Long Island. On the morning of the 11th, he divided his army, and leaving a powerful body to make a frontal attack, marched upriver with Cornwallis, crossed it, and descended on Washington's right flank. His tactics went like clockwork. The attack was successful, disorder spread, and the British troops on the far bank crossed the river and drove a whole American force before them. By sunset, Washington was in full retreat. As the Marquis de Lafayette, a young French volunteer in the American army, described it, "Fugitives, cannon, and baggage crowded without order into the road." But here, as at Long Island, Howe refused to pursue and capture the enemy. He was content. On September the 26th, his advance guards entered Philadelphia. There was a confused fight to the north of the city at Germantown, but the British pressed on, and soon afterwards the capital fell. By now, however, the London plans for the Northern Theatre were beginning to miscarry. Burgoyne, with a few hundred Indians and 7,000 regulars, of whom half were Germans, was moving through the Canadian forests, expecting to join with the British forces from New York. After an arduous march, he reached Fort Ticonderoga, and found that the Americans had retired, leaving their artillery behind them. He pushed eagerly southwards. If only Howe was moving up to West Point, nothing could prevent an overwhelming success. But where was Howe? On the day that Burgoyne moved upon the next American fort, Howe had sailed southwards from New York. All concerned were confident that after capturing Philadelphia, Howe could quickly return to New York and reach out to the expedition from Canada. He failed to do so, and Burgoyne paid the price. As Burgoyne advanced, the New England militia gathered against him. He was a popular and dashing commander, but the country was difficult, he was harassed by raids, and his troops began to falter and to dwindle. He could still succeed if help came from New York. Clinton's garrison there had been halved since Howe had called upon him for reinforcements. Nevertheless, Clinton marched north and managed to capture West Point. But as the autumn rains descended, Burgoyne was cornered at Saratoga, and the New Englanders, their strength daily increasing, closed in. He was only 50 miles from Albany, where he should have met the column from New York, but he could make no headway. Days of hard fighting in the woodlands followed. His supplies ran low, and he was heavily outnumbered. The Americans were operating in their own country by their own methods. Each man fighting mostly on his own initiative, hiding behind bushes and in the tops of trees, they inflicted severe casualties upon some of the best regiments that Europe could muster. The precise drill and formations of Burgoyne's men had no effect. An American deserter brought news that Clinton was moving northwards. It was too late. The Germans refused to fight any longer, and on October the 17th, 1777, Burgoyne surrendered to the American commander, Horatio Gates. The surrender terms were violated by Congress, and the main body of his army were kept prisoners until the signing of the peace. Burgoyne returned to England to attack and be attacked by the ministry. At this point in the struggle, the old world stepped in to aid and comfort the new. Although militarily indecisive in America, Saratoga had an immediate effect in France. The French, though technically at peace with Britain, had been supplying the patriots with arms, and French volunteers were serving in the colonial army. At Versailles, Benjamin Franklin and Silas Deane had been urging an open alliance, but for a year both sides had wavered. The French ministers hesitated to support the cause of liberty overseas while suppressing it at home, and many Americans feared that France would exact a heavy price for declaring war on England. Now all doubts were swept away. The colonists could not survive without French supplies, and the mass of Frenchmen were vehement to avenge the defeats of the 7 Years' War. The French navy had been strengthened. The British fleet was disintegrating. And when the news arrived of Saratoga, Louis XVI resolved on an official alliance. There was consternation in London, where the Whig opposition had long warned the government against harsh dealings with the colonists, and the British ministry formulated a generous compromise. It was too late. On February the 6th, 1778, before the Congress could be apprised of the new offer, Benjamin Franklin signed an alliance with France. Thus began another world war, and Britain was now without a single ally. She had lost one army as prisoners in America. There were no more troops to be hired in Germany. Old fears of invasion spread panic through the country. The ministry was discredited. In the agony, all minds except the king's turned to Chatham. On April the 7th, Chatham dragged himself upon crutches to make his last speech against an opposition address for recalling the army in America. He had always stood for conciliation and not for surrender. The corpse-like figure, swathed in flannel bandages, tottered to its feet. The house was hushed with the anticipation of death. In whispering sentences, shot through with a sudden gleam of fierce anger, he made his attack against the dismemberment of this ancient and most noble monarchy. He warned the nation of the dangers of French intervention and the use of German mercenaries. He scourged his countrymen for their inhumanity. "My lords, if I were an American as I am an Englishman, while a foreign troop was landed in my country, I never would lay down my arms. Never, never, never." He dismissed the threat of invasion with contemptuous sarcasm. He struggled to speak again after the reply of the opposition leader, the Duke of Richmond, but collapsed senseless in an apoplectic fit. On May the 11th, he died as his son William was reading to him from Homer the solemn scene of Hector's funeral and the deep despair of Troy. George III displayed his smallness of mind by opposing the plan to erect a monument, which would be, he said, "an offensive measure to me personally." But the city of London defied him, and Burke's inscription was a fitting memorial. "The means by which Providence raises a nation to greatness are the virtues infused into great men." Such men were very few in the England of Lord North. Chapter 8 The United States. Washington, in 1777, took up his winter quarters at Valley Forge, to the north of Philadelphia. At the end of every campaign, there were many desertions, and he was now reduced to about 9,000 men, of whom another third were to melt away by the spring. Short of clothing and shelter, they shivered and grumbled through the winter months, while in Philadelphia, a score of miles away, nearly 20,000 well-equipped English troops were quartered in comfort. The social season was at its height, and the numerous loyalists in the capital made the stay of Howe and his officers pleasing and cheerful. The British made no move to attack the Patriot Army. While Washington could not count on provisions for his men even a day in advance, Howe danced and gambled in Philadelphia. As at Long Island, as at White Plains, as at the Brandywine River, he refused to follow up his victory in the field and annihilate his enemy. Unnerved, perhaps, by the carnage at Bunker Hill, and still hoping for conciliation, he did nothing. Some inkling of his reluctance may have reached the ears of the government. At any rate, when news of the French alliance with the rebels reached England at the beginning of the new year, he was recalled. Howe's successor was Sir Henry Clinton, the former commander of New York, who held very different views on the conduct of hostilities. He perceived that European tactics of march and countermarch, and the siege and capture of towns and cities, would never prevail against an armed and scattered population. The solution, he thought, was to occupy and settle the whole country. He also made a momentous change of strategy. He resolved to abandon the offensive in the north and begin the process of reduction by subduing the south. Here was the bulk of the population and the wealth, and the main repository of such supplies as the continent could furnish. Here also were many loyalists. They must be heartened and organized. A new base would be needed, for New York was too far away, and Clinton's eye rested on Charleston and Savannah. Much could be said for all this, and much might have been achieved if he'd been allowed to try it out. But there now appeared a new force which, abruptly checked and in time, proved deadly to the realization of these large plans. Savannah was 800 miles and 50 days' march from New York. Hitherto, Britain had held command of the sea and could shift her troops by salt water far more speedily than the Patriots could move by land. But all was now changed by the intervention of France and the French fleet. Sea power was henceforth to dominate and decide the American struggle for independence, and Clinton soon received a sharp reminder that this was now in dispute. In April 1778, 12 French ships of the line, mounting, with their attendant frigates, over 800 guns, set sail from Toulon. 4,000 soldiers were on board. News of their approach reached Clinton, and it became his immediate and vital task to stop them seizing his main base at New York. If they captured the port, or even blockaded the mouth of the Hudson, his whole position on the continent would be imperiled. On June the 18th, he accordingly abandoned Philadelphia and marched rapidly across New Jersey with 10,000 troops. Washington, his army swollen by spring recruiting to about equal strength, set off in parallel line of pursuit. At Monmouth Courthouse, there was a confused fight. Clinton beat off the Americans, not without heavy loss, and did not reach New York till the beginning of July. He was only just in time. On the very day of his arrival, a French fleet under D'Estaing appeared off the city. They were confronted by a British squadron under Admiral Howe, brother of the superseded military commander, and for weeks the two forces manoeuvred outside the harbour. The French attempted to seize Rhode Island, but were frustrated, and Howe, in a series of operations which has drawn high praise from American naval historians, defeated all efforts by his opponent to intervene. In the autumn, D'Estaing abandoned the struggle and sailed for the West Indies. Here also Clinton had managed to forestall the French. Earlier in the year, he'd sent troops to St. Lucia. D'Estaing arrived too late to intercept them, and this strategic island became a British base. Nevertheless, these successes could not disguise the root facts that Clinton's campaign against the South had been delayed for a year, and that Britain was no longer in undisputed command of the sea. The French fleet dominated the Channel and hindered the transport to New York of men and supplies from Britain, while New England privateers waged a lively and profitable warfare against English commerce. Military operations in America came slowly to a standstill, and although 3,000 of Clinton's troops occupied Savannah in Georgia on December the 29th, his plans for subduing the rebels from a loyalist base in the South were hampered and curtailed. A furious civil war between loyalists and patriots had erupted in these regions, but he could do little to help. Stalemate continued throughout 1779, and for a time the main seat of war shifted from the New World. Both armies in America were crippled. The American, from the financial chaos and weak credit of the Congress government, and the British, for want of reinforcements. Fear of invasion gripped the British government, and troops intended for Clinton were kept in the British Isles. The French, for their part, realized that they could get all they wanted in America by fighting Britain on the high seas, and this was anyway much more to the taste of the autocratic government at Versailles than helping Republican rebels. Except for a few volunteers, they did not at this stage send any military or naval help to